Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, 1 year on from the historic G8 meeting in Glen Eagles, how far have we come in the campaign to make poverty history? Who was the beloved disciple of Christ? Pope Benedict continues his weekly catechesis on the apostles. But first, as the World Meeting of Families takes place in Valencia, Spain, we ask, what are the major challenges facing Catholic families today? Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict heads off to Valencia this Saturday to attend the 5th World Meeting of Families that has been taking place in the Spanish city throughout this week. During his 2-day visit, the Pope will preside at Mass and a youth vigil to mark the closing of this event, and he'll meet privately with Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Zapatero and King Juan Carlos. The papal visit takes place 13 years after Pope John Paul II embarked on his last visit to Spain. On that occasion, he warned the country was drifting away from traditional Catholic values, liberalizing divorce and abortion laws, threatening marriage and the right to life. Well, those concerns are familiar to church leaders in almost all Western countries today, where the institution of marriage and the family is undermined by the growing incidence of divorce, one-parent families, cohabitation, and more recently moves to legalize same-sex unions.
You know, when two people get married, whatever their faith or cultural background is, they want to make it last and to be a really good and deep relationship. But they meet up with a society that doesn't have those values and doesn't support marriage.
Auxiliary Bishop John Hine of Southwark in the UK is chairman of the Church's Committee for Marriage and Family Life. My colleague Susie Hodges talked to him about the problems facing families in England and Wales and what they're expecting from Pope Benedict at this World Meeting of Families in Spain.
Pope Benedict hasn't made many international trips since becoming Pope. So how significant do you believe his decision is to attend the World Meeting of the Families in Valencia, Spain?
I think it is indeed very significant because it points out the importance of marriage and family life in his whole whole responsibility for the church, really. And so I'm delighted that he's going to be there.
Where do you think the family is most under attack?
Well, I think certainly in European societies there's a great deal of adverse culture, if you like, for marriage. But I think and I really hope that our meeting is going to centre around the positive, about sharing of good practice, of positive ideas, of ways forward. Because I'm very aware that, certainly in our society, that families get quite isolated sometimes, and they get the impression sometimes that they're the only ones trying to live the Christian values in the home, and they need support and they need encouragement and they need sort of positive examples that will inspire them in some way.
And what do you think the faithful are expecting from Pope Benedict on this theme?
Well, I believe that he's a very profound thinker, and his encyclical Deus Caritas Est was full of really positive things about human love, and I'm hoping that this will be built on and will become something which we can, if you like, put feet on within the domestic home.
Do you think then that the challenges facing the family is one of the most critical issues facing the church today?
I think the family has always been at the very heart of the church. And our exercise that we did here in England and Wales in 2004, where we listened to families throughout the whole of the countries, proved that families were really trying to live the gospel within the home, that they did have a spirituality, but they didn't really always recognize it and value it as such. So it needs to be expressed and put in a way that helps people and encourages them. And I think this is the way that they will learn to stand up against the erosive values of the society.
When we listened to families in 2004, we found a varying picture. Many of our families found a great deal of support for their marriage and family life from the relationships they have with others in their parishes.
Elizabeth Davies is Family Project Officer for the Catholic Bishops' Conference in England and Wales.
At the moment, we're unrolling across the diocese a programme called Everybody's Welcome, and many dioceses are involved in this. And they're looking at how the parish can be more sensitive to what married couples need at various stages of their relationship and what children need, especially teenagers.
The teens is a difficult age. It's often an age, in fact, where children tend to drift away from the church. How can we stop that?
I think we have to have programmes that begin at the very start of human life. We have great opportunities as a church at baptism. We follow that up with the sacraments of initiation, communion and reconciliation. And we have a great foundation. And this has to be seen as a long-term, lifelong project. It's not a question of just being friendly to teenagers, but having shown love and acceptance and understanding and care of them right from the moment they were being born.
And how easy is it and how effective are parents being at passing on their Catholic faith to their children?
I think it's very challenging for parents because they really aren't clear what passing on the faith necessarily means these days, especially in families where the parents may not share faith, where the families are broken, they're not sure if the school should take responsibility or the parish, and there's very little clarity shared between us, perhaps on what the role of grandparents and parents is in passing on the faith.
How threatening do you find the growing trend towards legalising same-sex unions that we've now seen in a number of Western countries?
Well, anything that actually erodes the status of marriage as we understand it, of course, doesn't help. On the other hand, I think we shouldn't concentrate on the negatives. We've got so many good things to promote about marriage and family life that we need to concentrate on those. And if we promote them in the right way, I'm sure that people will, you know, be inspired by them and want more of that.
But are we promoting in the right way? Do you think there could be some, looking at how the church is managing on this issue?
I think we can always do better. We are having a great symposium, an international symposium in the autumn in this country, where we're gathering a lot of quite notable people, as well as our own workers in marriage and family life together, to talk about the whole area of domestic spirituality. And I'm sure that out of that will come something of an agenda for us for the way forward. I'm sure we won't have all the answers, but perhaps we'll have some.
You've presumably come across a great number of married couples in your work. Have you any very brief anecdotes that you can share with us that somehow sum up, A, the problems or the threats facing the family or how they've overcome them?
I think one of the things that we heard quite often was how isolated Christian families can become. People nowadays move away from their homes, they don't have the benefit of extended family around them, and therefore they need support and welcome in the parish, and they look for that. They look really for family-friendly parishes, and that's what we have been promoting, and which a lot of dioceses are working with in England and Wales at the moment.
Now, when it comes to marriage in particular, of course, the last few decades have seen a steep increase in the divorce rate. Why is that?
That's a huge question. I think one of the problems has been identified by an organisation in this country called One Plus One, whose research really has shown that nowadays what is needed most by married couples is some help on the whole area of conflict resolution. And they, if they're not able to deal with conflict, which is the part of any intimate relationship, then it's very difficult for them to sustain that relationship.
One very last brief question. I mean, how optimistic do you feel then about the state of the family?
Well, I think that what we want as Catholics and as Christians is actually what all human beings want. The human needs for love and so on are the same, whoever they are. And so that's the basis we should work from and share our experiences and our hopes and our ways forward with everyone. I'm sure this will be a great means of evangelization.
Susie Hodges was talking there to Auxiliary Bishop John Hine of Southwark, who is chairman of the Church's Committee for Marriage and Family Life, and to Elizabeth Davis, Family Project Officer for the Catholic Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. Meanwhile, here in the Vatican on Wednesday, thousands of pilgrims braved the scorching sun as they gathered in St. Peter's Square to attend Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. My colleague Charles Collins takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
It was his last weekly general audience before August. The Holy Father will be going on vacation after returning from Spain this weekend. During the audience, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on the apostles.
Dear brothers and sisters, continuing our weekly catechesis on the Church's apostolic ministry, we now consider the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee and the brother of James. Among the apostles, John appears with Peter and James as part of a smaller group which accompanies Jesus at significant moments of his public ministry. After the resurrection, it was John who recognized the risen Lord standing on the shore and pointed him out to Peter. St. Paul refers to him as one of the columns of the early church in Jerusalem. According to tradition, John is a beloved disciple mentioned in the fourth gospel who reclined next to the Lord at the Last Supper, stood with Mary at the foot of the cross, and beheld the empty tomb. As such, he is a model for all believers who are called to establish a deep personal friendship with Jesus. In the Eastern tradition, John is venerated as a theologian for the depth of his religious and contemplative vision. By his prayers, May we more fully experience the mystery of the Father's love revealed in Christ, and respond by offering our lives even more generously to Him.
After the catechesis, the Holy Father turned his thoughts to the Ecumenical Patriarch's 6th International Symposium on the Environment, which is about to begin in Brazil.
Auspico che tale importante iniziativa, promossa dal Patriarca di Costantinopoli Bartolomeo I,
the Holy Father said that he hoped that this important initiative promoted by Bartholomew I will contribute to the promotion of a greater respect for nature, which he says is entrusted to the responsibility of man by God. At the end of the audience, the Holy Father bestowed his apostolic blessing on the crowd, which we share with you now. I'm Charles Collins.
Sit nomen Domini benedictum.
Ex hoc nunc et usque in saeculum.
Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini.
Qui fecit caelum et terram.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
Ago, over 200,000 people descended on Edinburgh in Scotland as the Make Poverty History campaign reached a climax ahead of the G8 meeting of world leaders in nearby Gleneagles. In other cities across the world, billions of people either attended or watched the mega Live 8 concerts, also aimed at focusing world attention on the need to provide debt relief, more aid, and better trade agreements for people in the world's poorest nations. So, 1 year on, what exactly did that campaign achieve? Have pledges made at the summit translated into improved living conditions for people struggling daily against the vicious cycles of poverty, sickness, and despair? In short, did the mass mobilization succeed in persuading G8 leaders to make poverty history?
I think it certainly impressed them.
George Gelber is head of policy with CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development.
And it certainly enabled the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to point to the groundswell of public opinion, because there's no doubt that he was the person pressing the aid package on his fellow G8 leaders.
But in terms of the actual promises that they were able to come up with, you mentioned aid, of course, the other two areas, debt relief and trade. Just if you like, give us a view a year on from how much those promises really have meant a difference to people on the ground in the countries where you're working.
Let's start with debt relief. Debt relief, in fact, was negotiated by the finance ministers and was signed off at the end of the year by the IMF and 3 months later at its spring meetings by the World Bank. And that means that developing countries are already benefiting because they are not having to pay their debt service to the multilateral institutions. And this money is going into investments that benefit the poor, principally education and health. And we know that in Zambia they've taken on more teachers and more health personnel. Other countries have also benefited. Aid is more problematic. The G8 leaders promised to raise the level of global aid by an additional $50 billion a year by 2010. And $20 billion is new money. Now, this compares with debt relief, which is worth $1 billion a year, mainly to African countries, and another $1 billion a year to Nigeria alone. So you can see that aid is worth a lot more in terms of the actual resource transfer than debt relief. And, of course, pledges that are made in July in 1 year take some time to begin to work their way through the system, so that it is, I think, unrealistic to expect that the full amount of aid will be delivered. But it's very important that countries put themselves on a trajectory that will enable them to deliver the full additional $50 billion in 2010. If they backload it, if they delay raising aid up till 2008 and 2009, then the leap that they will have to make in 2010 will be simply too great, and they will fail to do that.
Is it not true in some cases, though, that governments are proposing taking money from their aid budget and using it on debt relief? In other words, confusing the statistics to make it look as though more money is actually going out to help these developing countries?
Well, I don't think it's a deliberate attempt to confuse people. Debt relief is counted as aid, and the huge debt relief deals agreed for Iraq and for Nigeria have certainly inflated aid budgets this year, and it's disingenuous if governments are claiming that this is a huge increase in aid. And of course, it will boomerang on them, because now that this debt relief for Nigeria and Iraq is out of the way, their aid budgets will actually appear to fall next year, when of course they should be rising. But I think debt relief has to be accounted for, and certainly Make Poverty History have said all along that it should be accounted for separately.
You mentioned the case of Zambia, which is perhaps one of the strongest examples of success where money has gone into education, into healthcare. There are other countries where there are many concerns about the way that the governments, the African governments, have used the money to finance either conflicts or money has been lost through corruption. What's your view on that?
This is a huge, huge problem with which we are beginning to get to grips. NGOs who've been clamoring for more aid and more debt relief have in the past been reluctant to deal with the issue of corruption, because we didn't want to undermine public support for more aid and debt relief by pointing to the problems. But of course, now we have to look at how all these additional resources are actually going to deliver benefits for poor people. And corruption is one of the issues that we're discussing. Now, the countries that are receiving debt relief have been given a good enough bill of health by donors, by the World Bank. They're recognized as reasonably honest, reasonably competent, and committed to poverty reduction. There are large numbers of other countries which our own Department for International Development calls fragile states, where you can't say the same thing. And these fragile states stand outside the debt relief agreements and aid agreements, and donors have to have a much more careful eye on the aid that they provide. They have to audit the programs, have tightly controlled programs, and so on. This isn't ideal, but this is the way that they're tackling it. And of course, simply to give the money open-handedly to governments which do not satisfy basic criteria of honesty or competence would be to waste it, and would be to lose the trust of our own taxpayers, who are the ultimate providers of this assistance.
You're talking about corruption then as one of the biggest challenges perhaps facing this whole Make Poverty History campaign. What, in your view, are the strongest guarantees? What are the best ways in which people can pressure these governments to really deliver the money that is coming through to them?
I don't think there's any silver bullet that can guarantee that aid money is spent well. I think that it's a long-term process, and for us NGOs, we have a crucial role to play in building up, helping to build up civil society in those countries, so that it's civil society that holds their governments to account, because ultimately it is the citizens of a country who have to hold their government to account, along with their institutions like parliament and the courts. But this is long-term, and it certainly isn't easy. And in some countries, perhaps recently emerging from conflict, you find that civil society, NGOs, even the church can be somewhat cowed by authoritarian governments.
The churches have played an important role, haven't they, in this whole Make Poverty History campaign, both here in the West and also in the countries that are the recipients of a lot of this money?
Indeed, they have. And I think that the churches do speak with a degree of authority. And also, church leaders perhaps have greater freedom to express themselves than an ordinary layperson. An archbishop is an impressive figure, and governments are much more reluctant to stamp down on an archbishop than they would be, say, on just an ordinary NGO campaigner. So there's a certain amount of what the Latin Americans would call fuero, or freedom for the church to speak out. And of course, we're very glad that church leaders from around the world have really lent their support to Make Poverty History.
Looking ahead now to the St. Petersburg summit, what would be your message then to anybody who wants to stay involved with this campaign to try and see more progress on this issue?
I think we have to stay engaged. Priorities for the Russians at St. Petersburg are going to be energy and security, which are obviously relevant but not directly relevant to the concerns of Make Poverty History. Our goal now is to look forward to the G8 in Germany next year, when 2 years after Gleneagles, when we really should be able to see whether the governments are delivering on the promises that they made at Gleneagles. And of course, we looking back, we remember that the huge demonstration in favor of debt cancellation organized by Jubilee 2000 at the 1998 G8 held in Birmingham in England, which was followed by the G8 leaders agreeing to the heavily indebted poor country initiative on debt, which was the first time that the door was opened to debt relief for developing countries. So we're looking from Gleneagles in the UK last year, 2005, towards the German G8 in 2007.
My thanks there to George Gelber of CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. And that brings us to the end of today's programme, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. In the meantime, don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. The address is www.vaticanradio.org, and then click on the English icon. Listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.